Hey, Life Architects, Adam Carroll here with another episode of the Build a Bigger Life podcast. We are up to episode number 169, and today's guest is a woman named Sybil Solomon. Sybil is the founder of Money Habitudes, an incredible tool for gaining a better understanding of how you are with money. Interestingly, Sybil created this to help couples talk more openly and plainly about money and how they function together with it. As you likely know, money can be one of those topics that gets in the way of a marriage because of the lifelong garbage that's behind us in regards to this topic. We'll talk today on the show about how your money story impacts your life in a very big way, and by understanding that story can help you change the way you operate on a day-to-day basis as it relates to money and to your honey. The show today is sponsored by theshredmethod.com. Speaking of your honey, you know, you become a lot more attractive when there are no recurring debt payments every single month. I know for a fact. It happened with me. I lost my hair, I got older, I got wrinklier, and somehow I just got more attractive. It sounds awesome, doesn't it? Not the less hair and wrinklier, but no debt. I'm telling you, it is. The Shred Method is the fastest way to eliminate debt and build real wealth. And I pull no punches. I hold nothing in reserve. There are no big secrets to this strategy working. It literally is just math. And I teach it to you. We cover all this, how it works, why it works, what to do to make it work. All of it is in greater depth at theshredmethod.com. So what are you waiting for? Hundreds of couples now are blasting away debt and building equity that will ultimately enhance and enrich their cash flow. And, you know, the couples look sexier to one another when there's no debt. I'm just telling you, it's true. All right, now on to the interview with the founder of Money Habitudes, Sybil Solomon. Sybil Solomon, welcome to the Build a Bigger Life podcast.
Well, Adam, it's a delight to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I feel like this has been a long time coming, and I'm remiss for waiting so long to get in touch with you to have you on the show. For my listeners, it's for your own kind of edification here. I met Sybil at a conference years ago, and she handed me this deck of cards that's branded and labeled as the Money Habitudes deck. We're going to talk about that a little bit today. And I took it home. I used it, had the conversation with numbers, many, many, many people in my life, and they were all amazed and wowed and had lots of aha moments. So we're going to talk about the genesis of this, what it means, what the cards mean, depending on your personal money habitude. But before I begin, Sybil, the first question I ask of everyone, what do you love about your life right now?
Well, you caught me at a really great time because my life is in such a good place. You know, when you get to a place where it seems like everything's kind of working. Mm. Personally, I have two adult sons and I couldn't be prouder of them. And I love being friends with them as an adult, and that's always a great thing. I live in Montana where I can look out and see these gorgeous mountains. There's not many people, so during the pandemic, I could go anywhere I wanted. And professionally, after doing years of Money Habitudes, we now have a new website. We have some new features, and it just seems like I'm enjoying its success and able to just relax and go on with life.
I love it. I love all those things, especially being in Montana. Although I think I read in your bio, you sneak out in the wintertime, don't you?
I sneak out whenever I can because I love travel.
And this is in an RV. Is this right?
Often it's in an RV, but I also like to travel internationally. Yes. And going across country. We've done that a number of times, but you don't want to do it too many times in an RV. That gets kind of old.
I bet. I remember from our conversation very early on about the genesis of Money Habitudes. And I want to say that this is an accurate story. Hopefully I didn't make this up. You were working with couples, were you not, when you had this brainchild?
Couples was a part of it. But more than that, I was teaching a course at the university in planning for the third age. And working with individuals and couples, plus my graduate students, when this came up. So partially perfect memory. And then there was more to it than that.
Yes. Tell me a little bit about how did you cook up the idea? I mean, given the deck of cards, I imagine you and your husband are sitting there playing pinochle or you know, cribbage or something. And you were like, oh, this would be a great way to do this. How did it bubble up?
So the interesting thing is I have absolutely no background in finance, in any of these types of things. And it was simply curiosity that when I was teaching this course and I was working with people in different capacities as an executive coach, as a volunteer with couples, as a volunteer with women's issues, that money just kept coming up as an issue. And I wasn't bringing it up. And in the course I was teaching, we were talking about planning for the future in 8 different areas. And it was the money one where people kept coming up to me and having more questions. And I just became curious as they told me these stories that were so crazy. Like, I had a woman in her mid-30s who was working in a hospital, and she had never signed up for their retirement. And I said, why not? And they were matching at some ridiculous rate, like 7% right, or something. And she said, well, when I started, I thought I'd only be here a year or so, so it wouldn't be worth it. So I never did. And so now she's been there for over 8 years, and she has given up tens of thousands of dollars as a result.
Oh my goodness. And
I won't go into all the stories, but there were so many stories that just caught me by surprise that I said, why do people do this? And why do they do so many things that they told me they felt ashamed and embarrassed by, or they felt stupid? So just on a whim, I decided to start reading research about it. And that sounds kind of nerdy, but that's okay. So I looked up the research in finance, psychology, behavioral economics, and addiction. And what I saw were patterns. So though the patterns that I saw became the 6 different habitudes that we'll talk about. Yep. And the 3 biggest takeaways that I had from all the research was that there were 3 things. One was money was the most difficult topic for people to talk about. Mm. 2 was that what we know and what our intentions are not necessarily at all aligned with what we actually do. And the 3rd takeaway was that most of the decisions and behaviors we have, we do them blissfully. We're totally mindless of why we did them.
Yeah, it's all unconscious, subconscious stuff, right? From early on, more than likely. I want to take each one of those one by one. Why is money so stinking hard to talk about?
I'm so glad you asked that question. So when we think about money, money is simply a form of exchange for goods, services, experiences. And if we could just leave it at that, that would be fine. The problem is that we associate money with so many highly emotional topics. Mm. So for some people, money represents love or fear, security, control, acceptance. There, Dr. Gottman, who's a psychologist and is very well known, he sat down and he came up with 100 different emotional connections that he could think of for money before he stopped, right? So what happens is, let's say you come home and your wife says to you, I don't know if you have a wife, but let's just say you have a wife, and you come home and she says, I see this charge at Home Depot for $149. What was that? And instead of just saying, I needed some new parts for the lawnmower, you take that in and it's like, what, I have to account for everything? You know, I can't even spend something. And you immediately attach that there is a hidden agenda for what your wife is asking you. And all she's actually asking you for is, when she's doing her bookkeeping or for your household stuff, what column should she put this expense under, right? And that's what we do all the time. We attach different meanings to what other people are asking us or what the situation is.
Yes.
It's really pretty overwhelming. People identify their success with money.
Yes.
Just one thing. So when it becomes so difficult to talk about, because we're not really ever talking about money, we're almost always talking about what are the values and the emotions that underlie that.
Yes.
And if you don't talk about that and you just keep arguing about money or making another budget, that's the other big thing. People make budgets. People have financial plans. They're beautiful. They're really well thought out. Yep. The problem is that you don't necessarily follow through because of the emotions around money in the moment.
Right. The metaphor that comes to mind when you describe that is like trying to grow a garden in cement.
Oh, I like that.
Because our you know, the budget is the garden. We're planting these seeds. This is what we should be doing. Here's how our money should you know, travel through our household and our personal economy. And yet we're trying to plant it in some subconscious, you know, maybe it's not concrete, but very hardened clay at the very minimum, which is our memories and our history and what we remember growing up. I want to get your take on this. There was a friend of mine who went through Money Habitudes with me, and we were talking through kind of what she is, what her husband is in terms of their primary money habitude. And she was planning. Secondary was security. He was a little more status, but also planning. But when we started going through what their backstory was, she remembers her very earliest money memory was hearing a knock at the door and the sheriff being there serving foreclosure papers.
Mm.
And so, you know, money for her had fear attached to it and had a sense of we could lose our home if we're not smart about this, so we better plan. But sometimes what I find is that people plan almost to an excess in order to protect themselves from this script that their parents ran, but is not it shouldn't be present in their current life.
Right.
Yeah. What's your take?
I personally have that. I've never had to worry about having a roof over my head growing up. I never had to worry about not having enough food, but my father had to.
Mm.
And there were times when they literally snuck out in the middle of the night because the rent was due and had no place to stay. And that was his mother with five children. Mm. Right. So I inherited his messages, and security became really important to me, even though I didn't have the fear of these horrible things actually happening in my life.
Yeah. Amazing.
So you got it. Actually, you just hit on one of the ways that we get our messages through our family is through our family. And it comes out in three different ways. We get three different sets of messages. One is the overt messages that says, you know, anytime you get money, you have to take part of it and save it for charity. We get very covert messages, which as people are, we're seeing what people are, our parents are doing, and it may be very different than what they're telling us. Maybe they're spending money in ways that seems pretty frivolous, but they're telling us to save, right?
Right, right.
And there's the inherited messages, like we were just talking about, where just knowing your family's history, it's almost like in your DNA that you get those messages as well.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. A good friend of mine has also used Money Habitudes in some of his coaching. And he used to tell me that money could always, it was always, there was always a delay. It was always like, well, I'll get to that someday. And mm-hmm. he traced it back to his father when his father was a young dad and he was a young child. His dad would quiz him on the stock ticker symbols. So what's Apple, AAPL? What's, you know, what's Walmart, WMT? And he would say, Dad, I want you to teach me how to invest. And he'd say, I will soon, son, someday I'll teach you how to invest. And someday never came. Mm-hmm. And he said, I equated the messaging that I got, which I think would probably be more of a covert message, is I want to teach you how to invest, but I'm not going to. I'm going to put it off and put it off and put it off. And he said the way that manifested for him was he would let credit card bills pile up and he wouldn't open them because it could wait. He would let student loan bills pile up because it could wait. And he was getting charged late fees and overdrafts and all those things because he wasn't paying attention because money could wait. Mm-hmm. And so just super fascinating. I love all this. I love the human behavior aspect of it. I want to circle back to one thing you said, Sybil, which was that sometimes our money habitude does not align with our actions. What do you mean by that?
Okay. So what I think I was saying was that we might know how to do a budget. We might know that we shouldn't be spending money on certain things. I think everybody knows that you shouldn't be spending more money than you have. And yet we do it all the time. Yeah. Right? And the reason that we do is that if you think of the brain in two pieces, there's the piece of the brain that's the newest part. It's really logical. It looks at long-term types of things and consequences. It says, if I'm at A and I want to get to B, this is how much money I should save each month. And it's beautiful. Unfortunately, what happens is the emotional part of the brain, which is older, it actually sends five times more messages to get you to behave than the logical part. So let's say that, you know, you've said, I'm going to go out to eat one night a week, and this is how much money I'm going to spend. And that's going to be on Saturday night. Well, it's Tuesday, and you've had a really hard day. So even though you know better, you stop and you pick up food or go out to eat with your buddies. Yep. And you didn't budget for it, but you knew it. And even in your head, you're saying, I know I really shouldn't be spending this money. So you're really functioning from the emotional part of the brain. But then, because we're all smart people, what we do is we are so good at rationalizing. We then say, but I've had a really hard day today. And yesterday I had planned to buy a new shirt and I didn't even buy it. So I have that extra money anyway. Right. We do such a good job at rationalizing that we convince ourselves that what we're saying is logical. So we might know what our goals are. We might know how to reach those goals. But that's not necessarily aligned with what we actually do in the end.
Right.
The goal is if you can become aware of what motivates you and what reinforces you, then you have control. Mm. And that's what I'm all about. Not telling you what to do, but of helping you understand what motivates you.
Right.
So you can put the pieces in place to either avoid those situations that you don't want to be in,
right,
or you can put the pieces in place that teach you how to respond in a different way. So you're not a deer in the headlights every time you're facing that situation.
Right. So what I hear in that is someone that maybe has a hard time saving or they are prone to overspending. We have to get them tied to the emotional feeling of what having 6 months worth of living expenses in the bank feels like to them. What would that security feel like? What would be the emotion you're feeling with that? And can we make that stronger than, oh, that shirt's really cute, or I had a bad day, so I deserve to go out and spend some money, right? Am I hearing that correctly?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes.
We typically ask when we're doing financial coach training, we ask leverage questions. So the way that our questioning goes is, you know, what would you like to accomplish? And someone says, oh, I'd love to take a great vacation. Tell me specifically where you would like to go and you know, how long would you stay and who would you take and where, what kind of places would you stay? And they create this very specific vision of it. And then our leverage question is, what will it feel like when you experience that?
Absolutely.
And, you know, and when they get in their head and in the right, the right side of their brain, right, is the thinking side or the emotive side, they get engaged in that and you can see them go, oh, that's why, okay. So now I know what I need to do differently in order to get there.
So I think one of the things that really helps you be successful with that is that you start out by helping them become very specific. Right? Mm-hmm. When people say, oh, I want a house, or I want a car, or I want to go to school, until they break it down to say, what does that look like? Because and you mentioned couples earlier, when you're talking about a couple and you say, they're talking about, we want a house. Well, what does that mean to you? So until they have the conversation and do break it down to the specifics you're talking about, a 3-bedroom house, a 4-bedroom house, something that we're going to stretch as far as we can to buy it because we think we're going to be there forever, or something that we're going to get into and then keep as an investment. Until you get down to the nitty gritty of what's the house going to look like, what neighborhood is it going to be in,
yes,
then they don't have that vision. And you can't get down to the next part where you're really talking about, you know, not only what will it feel like in the long term, but how, instead of saying, oh, there's all these obstacles, well, what are the obstacles? How can we make this happen? Mm-hmm. How can we work around those obstacles. But it's your very first thing with asking for the specifics that gets people on that track so they can make it happen.
Yes. The last comment you mentioned on of the three things was, I think, the unconscious messaging, or the fact that we are making these decisions autonomously, right? We're just, it's, they happen. We don't even think about it. It's second nature to us. You and I met at a higher education financial wellness conference. Mm-hmm. So it was really geared around, how do we make sure that college campuses and the students that live there are financially well? They are doing the right things, not getting in over their head in debt, et cetera, et cetera. But I maintain that one of the messages that they're getting is go to school, get a degree, get a good job. It's been that way for years and years. Only the narrative now has changed. And so they go and they do that with a very non-specific goal in mind. I just need a degree. And without realizing that you're going to take on tens of thousands of dollars in debt, potentially, you may not get a job in that major. You probably will struggle financially for 10 to 20 years. How do you reconcile those two? Like, what is your advice to parents so that we don't feed our kids the subconscious, you know, must go on this path and, you know, end up where I end up?
Wow. Now that's a really loaded question. I'm not sure if I can take on that whole question, but I am going to add one thing to what you were saying, is that whether kids go to college or not, there's so many other avenues open to them to be successful. I would go back to all this emotional stuff and money habitudes, right? And what status is. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about status, I'm not talking necessarily about being superficial and doing things, but that you want to look good to other people. Mm-hmm. So the parents of these kids going to college, they probably often have that message that in order for me to look successful, my son or daughter needs to look successful. And if all of my peers to be successful, their children are all going to college, then I feel that my children should also go to college.
Right.
And not only should they go to college, I want them to be able to hold their head up and be comfortable with their peers. So if all their peers are getting a car so that they can drive themselves, then I feel like my son or daughter should also have a car. And I was at one conference and the speaker was saying, and I just love this, that many of these students that are getting all kinds of loans are driving to campus with a U-Haul that has match linens, a big screen TV, flat screen TV, that they have a credit card that they don't know what to do with, and they haven't been given any kind of limits.
Yes.
They haven't been taught how to cook. So if they're not on a plan at the school, that they are eating all of their meals out. Yep. And the parents are feeling like they can't really afford college, but they really haven't separated out what's the difference between tuition, room and board, and all the other stuff.
So true.
And they may be spending $5,000 to $10,000 equipping their kid to go to school. That really, I mean, there's alternatives to that.
No doubt. No doubt about it. And you know what? As you're saying this, I'm like, oh my God, guilty. My daughter. She's got, you know, matching linens. She just ordered her TV.
Oh, no.
But now we will say this. She is a very conscious consumer, as you might imagine, being my daughter. So everything's bought on sale. She's mining her dollars and cents. And our plan was always, they are going to take care of the majority of that. You know, we'll support them somewhat, but there is skin in the game for the kids. And I love your point about, you know, we arm them with a credit card, but don't teach them how to use it. The fending for themselves food wise, another huge expense that as parents, you know, I think, listen, by the age of 18, if they can't stand on their own two feet in life, we have done a disservice to our kids.
Yes.
And so, yeah, it's so fascinating. How do you speak to, or if you would speak to what happens when a couple gets married and realizes they have very different money habitudes.
Wow. So the one of the things the research tells us is that within the first year of marriage, the biggest reason that people have a fight would be about money. But the main thing about betrayal is that one member will see something that indicates the other one has a big debt and they didn't know about it and they feel betrayed, right? Mm. So one example was there was a couple that got married and the woman just thought the guy was awesome. He drove this great car. He would pay when they went on vacations. He would bring her gifts and she was just like wowed. And they had been together for a few years. So it wasn't like an overnight spontaneous marriage. And then after they got married and the bills started coming in, the car wasn't paid for. The vacations were on credit cards. The gifts were on credit cards. The amount of debt that this person was carrying was amazing. And she had absolutely no idea. So she did feel betrayed. Mm-hmm. So she had, when she did her money habitudes, she came out with planning and security. Yeah. And he came out with planning and spontaneous, right? So you might say, it doesn't sound like he's planning. This guy was a really good planner. He planned, he wanted a big card. He put it on his credit card. Get a loan for it, right? So just because somebody plans doesn't mean they necessarily are planning for their long-term best interests, right?
Right.
So what happened, and you see this often, is that when couples get together, they actually attract the people who will balance them. Mm. And we look at that as conflict. That's usually how it manifests as conflict. Right. But in fact, they're balancing. So here this guy found this woman who cares about security and was really very cautious with money. And she was attracted to somebody who could just spend. She didn't know the history, but spend. So when they started, when they did their money habitudes and they saw that they were such opposites, as soon as they saw their cards turn over, they started to laugh and said, well, now we know why there's so much conflict in our marriage. But what they didn't see was how they were balancing each other. Mm-hmm. And I think that's incredibly important. And once people see that, it changes the whole conversation.
No
the
doubt.
Stories change so they understand. And the way that they approach things, you mentioned the word leverage before. Mm-hmm. Now we can leverage it. She actually was way too uptight. And it was really wonderful that he would bring in these more spontaneous things.
Yes.
He actually needed somebody to help rein him in a little bit and make things work better, but had never realized that they could work together and it didn't have to be this crazy seesaw of you're right, you're wrong kind of thing.
Right. So. Fascinating. And you're right. The whole idea of balancing each other out, it would be very easy to misdiagnose, I guess, if someone's planning and someone's spontaneous, like, well, we just weren't meant to be together. You know, we're going to have conflict all the time. And candidly, my wife is very security minded, very security minded. I remember when we first got married, I asked her, how much do you need in the bank to feel safe and secure? And she said $20,000. And I thought she'd hit the Listerine too hard that morning, Sybil. I was like, are you out of your mind? That is a crazy amount of money to have just sitting there. And we didn't have a pot to pee in or a window to throw it out of at the time. And yet for her, that was really important. For me, I am more planning. I'm probably a little bit of status because I do enjoy nicer things. And I think that was a byproduct of how I was raised. I joke about it, but every time we got a J. Crew catalog, I thought that meant we had to order something because we did typically growing up. And then I found out my dad, he put all that on credit card. And, you know, we thought, my sister and I thought we were somewhat affluent. My dad laughs about that and says, are you kidding me? There were months we couldn't pay our bills. So it's fascinating, but my wife and I have realized that she plays really great defense and I play really great offense in our marriage. Financially. And so for me, it's about, I'm going to make enough to really, to build a big life and provide for the family. And she manages and monitors what is spent. And she's looking for deals and discounts and repricing plane tickets and hotel rooms and that to make sure she gets the best deal. Cause for her, that's super important. And so I just love the notion. It is definitely a balancing act.
Right. And the other piece of it is that you have to talk. And it sounds like you and your wife do talk about things. You and your daughter do talk about things. And one of the other things that I was saying was an outcome from the research was how difficult it is to talk. And what I hear from people, and one of the reasons for developing Money Habitudes was because people didn't know how to talk. Most of our parents didn't talk to us about money. We didn't necessarily see our parents talk about money unless they were arguing about it. Mm-hmm. So we had no models. And we often don't have words to talk about it.
Right.
So what happens with Money Habitudes is we're not talking about dollars and cents and investments and stuff like that. So for people who don't want to talk about that part of it, you know, they don't have to. There's nothing in there that's math. A lot of people associate math with money, and math was not a good experience for them. So they want out of there. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. It's not a test. There's no right or wrong answers. So people can relax a little bit. So what we find is that even people who are very resistant to doing anything with money and taking responsibility or talking about it, yep, once they do Money Habitudes, they kind of relax and they now have almost like a new language. So instead of saying you're a spender and you're a saver, you know, they can talk about, well, security is really important to you, and the opportunity to be able to enjoy the moment and buy something or do something is really important to me. It just changes the total conversation.
Yes.
And most of us are pretty complex. Very few people are always one way. And that's one of the things that I find really annoying is that when you start name calling each other with being a spender or a saver or a hoarder or miser or whatever, it stops the conversation.
Right.
And with Money Habitudes, you're not a such and such, you're a combination. So when are you like this? And when are you like, like, what are the circumstances?
Yeah, I love some of the questions in the Money Habitude deck really hit home for me. Things like, when you're out with friends, you feel compelled to pick up the bill. that's always me. I'm always the first one to reach. And I think that was ingrained in me from my grandfather, who was like, I'll take it. And then there was this big hubbub about, you know, who was going to take it and generosity. And, but the questions are like so on point. And the fact that you have so many questions to ask and put in different categories, that I think you're spot on. You're not one thing. You're not a spender or a saver. You have saver tendencies. And at times you have security or carefree tendencies. And let's talk about each one of those individually. So, well, you mentioned status. So we've kind of gone through that a little bit, but give me a primer of someone who might have a status money habitude. What are they prone to do?
Okay. So if status is important to you, what's really important is that you make a positive impression. And that could be a whole lot of different things. For some people, it's having the latest clothes and the latest look and the latest hairdos and things like that. For other people, that's not true at all. When I think of status, it means that you either want to fit in or you want to stand out. Two very different things. So you could have somebody who actually has a lot of money, but the people that they want to hang out with and that they're comfortable with don't. So they will downplay their money and they will dress the way other people will. And on the other hand, if making a good impression is that you need to live in a big house or you need to always show that you've got enough money so that when you go out to eat, you always pay for other people. And by the way, paying for other people doesn't necessarily mean status. It may be just generosity. But if people are doing it with the idea subconsciously that if I pay for this, I will look better in their eyes. So think of status as you want to fit in, what will you do, or you want to stand out, what will you do? And I just have to give one quick story. Of times when people who work with other people around money can come across as really judgmental. Mm. So for example, there's a 12-year-old girl and the mom just spent $150 on getting her new clothes. And the financial educator working with her said, "Seriously? You just spent $150 on those clothes? you can't afford $150. And the way she came across felt very judgmental. Mm. Well, this young girl had had some serious emotional problems. Mm-hmm. She really had a difficult time fitting in. So as adults, we know that the clothes you wear, it's your personality. It's how you come across, whether or not people are going to like you. But to this little girl, those clothes were giving her a confidence. It was helping her to fit in with the other people. If I was her mother and I didn't have much money, I would have spent $150 on the clothes and figured out how I could pay for them, what I would have to do, right? So I think we have to be really careful when people are doing things not to be judgmental.
Right. That's a great reminder. What about giving?
Oh, you picked my two favorite ones. Right. So giving in terms of money habitudes means that you get joy from giving. You love being able to extend yourself to other people, and money is a piece of that. That sounds really good. And in the best sense of the word, it's really great. So now I'm going to give you the flip side. Sometimes we give too much. We may love giving and making other people's lives easier. We may love giving things to people because we know that they can't afford it, but we know they really would like to do it. So helping your kids buy a house, or you know, just taking them out to eat, we get joy from doing that. However, if you do it too much, what you're doing is enabling them. And when you're enabling them, you're also taking away their sense of feeling that they can trust themselves, that they can do this. So you have to be, givers have to be really careful about being enabling. The other thing too, is sometimes people give with that sense, instead of joy, they're giving with a sense of control and they want something. And sometimes it could be pretty subliminal. Like you're really nice to your kids and you're generous with your grandchildren because you want them to keep coming up, coming to visit you.
Right.
And so I think you need to do that. One of the things with giving that I recommend is that you look at pairing it with another habitude that you have that may be important to you. So somebody who gives but also has a lot of security, they will give, but they won't appear to be giving generously because they want to know what you want money for. Is it well researched? Yeah. How are you going to be accountable? How are you going to pay me back for this? And the person who's receiving the money might feel like, oh my God, I'm getting the third degree. They don't trust me.
Right.
Depending upon how you come across. For somebody who is giving and also has spontaneous, now if you're running a fundraiser, you want to invite them because you do a Mardi Gras night. I can guarantee you they're going to be there giving you their money. But spontaneous and giving for someone who's needing to mind their money, it can be pretty dangerous because you give without thinking twice and you might need to put some things in place to stop you. So when you go to the Mardi Gras night, that you have a fixed amount of money that you're going to spend and it keeps you on track. Or if you're going out with your friends, that you don't take your credit card, that you just take the amount of money that you could have, and you're not saying, oh, I'll treat everybody around, right, you know, on me.
Yeah.
So giving really, it's a good one. It's an important one.
I love the distinction you made on that first example. What came to mind was seeing someone panhandling on the side of the road. And I've heard this comment made in the past of, well, they'll just go, don't give them too much. They'll just go and buy, you know, booze with it. Which I think is more probably of a security mindset of what are they going to do with the money you're giving them? Or I'll give them food, but I won't give them money, you know, that kind of thing. Versus I've had friends that will, you know, they'll pull up to someone on the side of the road and give them $100 bill. And for them, it's just like, I'm going to be generous and they need it. I have it. I'm going to give it to them. So that may be more of a, if I'm hearing you correctly, more like giving spontaneous or giving carefree combination.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So along with that giving, I just want to say probably 10% of the people who are asking for money, they shouldn't be asking for money. The other people, for the most part, when they've done research, are actually using it for things like food and medicine and housing and things for themselves and for their children. Yeah. And that, again, we have to be not quite so judgmental sometimes. I have to tell you another quick story that I read. So there was a man who was in Israel, and he, every day we go to the Wailing Wall, and there was always a man there, and every day he would give him money. And one day he was there with a friend, and he went to give him money, and he didn't have any smaller bills. So he said to him, you know, I only have a $100 bill, you know, could you give me 50 back? And the guy pulls out a wad, a huge wad of bills, and gives him his $50 back. And the friend says to him, I cannot believe that that man has a wad of money and you are still giving him money. And he said to him, what you don't know is that he, the area that he lives in, he is the only man there, that all the other fathers and husbands have been killed in war. So there, he literally supports the women and children in this compound.
Wow.
And when I read that story, the first thing I thought was, I'm way too judgmental. I make assumptions way too quickly, and I need to be careful about doing that.
Yes.
I'm not encouraging people just to give their money away willy-nilly. But you know, you might also not want to be so judgmental sometimes.
Yes.
People are asking.
Such a good reminder. We have four more to crank through. Planning. Tell me about planning.
People who plan, we love people who plan if they're planning in a way that makes sense to us, right? If they're going to buy a new car, they're going to buy a car that fits into the amount of money that they can afford, and that is reasonable, and then not buying something that's $50,000 more. We love it when people plan so that they're thinking about their future and they're giving themselves options in their futures because they're putting aside money now. They're ready for emergencies. If they want to quit their job or if they lose their job for a pandemic or for any other reason, that they're not going to be destitute. So that's the best part about planning, right? The downside about planning is that sometimes people overplan. And I think you mentioned this with somebody earlier, that they plan to the point that they can't take advantage of opportunities. Mm-hmm. They're afraid to deviate once they have a plan. And as an executive coach, I've worked with people in their 40s and 50s that hate what they're doing, but they're stuck because that's what they plan to do. That's what they invested in. And they can't pivot in their lives as a result of that.
Wow. One
of the other things about planning is that planners can become judgmental. They think they're better than everyone else often because they're taking care of other people. And some of the downside is if you're taking care of other people because you feel responsible and you plan and you do that, then people become dependent upon you, right? Mm-hmm. It's a form of giving, but this time you're planning to give, you know, yes, to your children. And the other downside to planning is that we can become very judgmental. Once people start depending upon us, then we become judgmental. And if we're helping them financially, we feel we have the right to be judgmental because they're not taking care of themselves.
Right, right. Wow. How about spontaneous?
What do you think about spontaneous?
I find that I tend to be a little spontaneous. I have that as a money habitude, and it's probably when I sort the deck, I usually have four or five spontaneous cards. And so for me, but I'm planning in spontaneous, which seems really counterintuitive.
I think it sounds wonderful.
It is quite awesome, in my opinion. My wife doesn't always love it because she's planning in security. So the spontaneous side of me is, well, the joke is that she says, I'm the only person that can go to Costco with a shopping list and walk out with a kayak. And so that is the spontaneous side of me, that I can walk in and go, well, that looks cool. And I have the money, so I'm going to get that. And I've planned.
And it's a good price, right?
Right. And it's a good price. And so I don't feel bad about it. Hopefully I can explain it away when I get home. But the spontaneous card for me in the deck is really for those who have figured out that that money is a means to an end. And the end that they're likely looking for is happiness or fulfillment or fun or whatever it may be. And so I know those people because they'll say, oh, we take weekend trips all the time. We just decided on a whim to go here or there. And it's more about the experience or their lifestyle than it is about, you know, having millions of dollars in the bank at some point. That's my take.
Well, it's a good one. I like your take. And I like the fact that you've got planning and spontaneous together. So one of the things about one of the things that you bring up is that to me, money is a metaphor for life. And if you, if you're a person who spends spontaneous, you're probably a person who lives spontaneously. Nothing wrong with that unless you put yourself or anybody else at risk in the process of doing that. So when people are spontaneous, the question is, and I want to use your weekend vacation type people as an example, taking advantage of the weekend to do fun things instead of cleaning your house, I think that sounds like a really great thing.
Me too. And
if you have plenty of money and you're saving for your future, you're doing all these other things, and you could afford to hop on a plane and go someplace across the country or to some island and stay in a really nice place, and it's not jeopardizing a thing, well, good for you. That's great, right? However, we've gone through times, I actually have the same mentality. Weekends, I think, should be enjoyed. So when we were going through really difficult financial times, we had a tent and we had a car and we had two kids and a dog, and we tossed the kids and the dog and the food into the tent. I mean, sorry, tossed it all into the car. and we would go camping for the weekend. And, yeah. You know, depending upon where you live, camping can also be really very expensive and you can get very expensive tents. But in a lot of places where you live, you can camp for free on forest land.
Yeah.
And you take all your own food and the adventure, that was the adventure and that was the fun. And we really loved it. So there's so many different steps. Oh, so another story. Can I tell you another story?
Please. I love your stories.
Okay, so this is a Disney story. I had just come back from 3 weeks with my husband in Africa. And when we got back, the woman who cleaned my house said to me, boy, I would love to do something so exotic as that. Go to Africa for 3 weeks. Well, she had just that summer before taken her two children and her husband and herself, and they had gone to Disney. And I said to her, just out of curiosity, tell me how much you spent when you went to Disneyland. And she told me. And I said, do you know, your 1 week in Disneyland costs less than my 3 weeks with airfare going to Africa. And she said, no way. I said, yes, it did. And I showed her. So what happened, and it's called the stair step method. Yep. What happened is she looked at this as it's a once in a life experience that she could give her children.
Sure.
So they went during the high season because that's when her kids were out of school. They stayed on the Disney property. They did the Disney pictures. They did the Disney meetups with everything.
Oh, yeah.
They put their souvenirs there. They ate there. They did everything, right? When my family went to Disney with my two kids, my attitude was, we do lots of things with our kids. This is not a one-time be-all vacation. Right. And we're going to enjoy ourselves to the hilt, but we're not going straight to Disney. So we drove, which was fine. She could have driven too, but she didn't, right? Yep. So we drove down. So we had a car. We didn't have to rent one. We stayed in a motel. We weren't going for a motel experience. It was just a cheap place to stay. We were going to do all the fun things.
Yeah, for sure.
We had food with us so that we ate breakfast in the room, or maybe they came with breakfast. I don't remember. But we made sandwiches for lunch, or we would pick up sandwiches outside. And we would go to Disney. And my kids had a fabulous time. We did all of that stuff. We went to SeaWorld. We spent literally 25% of what she spent. And my kids today, you can, they're grown adults and they'll still tell you, we had a great time at Disney.
Right.
So you could do things that you want to do. The question is, how can you do them as opposed to, oh, I can't do that. I
can't do them. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So true. It's funny. I've shared on the show a number of times. In 2019, I took my family to Europe for a month and got that from a lot of people. Oh, it must be nice. Or matter of fact, there was a family not too far from us who the comment from the father was, must be nice being rich.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, first of all, I know that you make more than I do. And this has nothing to do about, you know, the money spent. I think it was more about time freedom than anything. And that we could get away for 30 days and go do that as a family. And so there are so many different facets of that, the vacation mentality and, oh, I'd love to do that. For most people, it's like, well, you can. How could we figure out how to make that happen?
Right.
And you could do it.
And I think that's probably your gift when you're working with people as a coach, is that you tell them, yes, you can. And yeah. Now let's look and see how you can do that.
Yeah. It's a great point. I just refuse to believe that anything can't be done. I mean, there's a dude who he ran 100 Ironman triathlons in 100 days. Tell me that something physical can't be done when someone goes and does that. You know, there are young teenagers who are building multi-million dollar businesses on YouTube, opening toys and unpacking things. Tell me you can't build a business doing the same thing. It's just, there are too many examples in our society today of things that are done for anyone to say, oh, that can't be done. It's like, you're wrong. It can, it is. Look around. Right. It's everywhere.
And I totally agree with that. And I also think if we're somebody who's working with people around money, that again, not to make assumptions, because you know there are some people, because of their race, their religion, their ethnicity, whatever the situation is, that there's literally policies that when they go to the bank and they know what they want to do, they can't get the loan.
Right.
And they don't have a support system like many people do, where right. they can get money from their father or from their uncle or their sister to make something happen.
Yeah.
So for some people, the obstacles are much bigger, but going in with that attitude of, let's see how we can help you make this happen and help them navigate the system often is just a gift that we give people.
Good call. Carefree and security are our last two, Sybil. Tell me about those.
So, people who are carefree, they really avoid money. It just disappears. They don't know where it is. They don't know what happened to it. They don't think about money. They don't want to talk about money. If they're in a relationship and their partner says, well, you know, we've talked about getting married or we've talked about getting a house. Let's figure out how we can do this. It's like, Sunday. Let's talk about that on Sunday. Let's talk about that next week, or you can take care of it. So it sounds like it's really being very irresponsible to people. And when you don't have enough money, it can be a very it can come across as really irresponsible.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that often that's because of messages that they have that maybe money is something that they don't enjoy, that money is associated with something that happened with them in the past,
right.
That's been used against them in some ways.
Yep.
And sometimes it's just because people's self-esteem says, you know, I don't think I'm good enough to understand how this happens.
Right.
And so we're not psychoanalyzing people. But again, we don't want to judge people. There's a lot of reasons that people are carefree. On the good side, we need carefree people because they roll with the punches. They're the ones that get involved in things that other people aren't even going to think to get involved with.
Right.
Because it sounded good. And, you know, it was easy. You know, my friend offered me this opportunity. It sounded like a great opportunity. I'm just going to do it. So they don't do any of the research. behind it. And oftentimes, carefree and spontaneous, people might say that they're the same. They're not. The spontaneous person is not avoiding money, is not mm-hmm. having a problem understanding money. They just have a problem sometimes with reacting too quickly and not doing their research, where the carefree person really doesn't know how much money they have in the bank or in their pocket. Yeah. And they don't want to find out. They just want to distance themselves from it.
I heard a story just the other day that would be illustrative of this. The woman said that her father and mother had divorced, and mom went to the mailbox almost every day looking for the child support checks. And it was held kind of over her head as to when she was going to get them or that she needed them. There was a lot of guilt and a lot of just kind of a power play that was put on by the ex. And she said, it disgusts me. I don't even want to think about it. Mm-hmm. And she's very carefree, has said, there's lots of bills that I need to take care of. I choose not to. And so, you know, to your point, I don't want to psychoanalyze, but behavior is multifaceted, right? It's multi-causal, multi-dimensional. But generally speaking, there is probably something that has happened in the past that mm-hmm. has caused some of that carefree nature.
So when you're working with a person like that, and you start off by having them show you what their debt is and how much money is coming in, and you say, well, you know, you give them a budget, right? Guaranteed, that budget is not going to work. So unless you can hear the story, and then you may or may not be able to help them, but unless you can hear the story, you're not going to know why things are going the way that they are.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I found that with some of the folks who are carefree, what they want is automation, or what they need maybe is automation.
Yeah.
So we automate bill pay, we automate savings. We go, hey, this is your fun money. You can be carefree with this account and spend as much as you want. Know that everything else is being taken care of. Mm-hmm. And how would that feel to you to know that you'd never have to touch these because the funds move as they're supposed to?
The other thing that you just said with automating is just simplifying. So when you get somebody in there who gets a lot of carefree cards or on their online version, they get carefree, that these are not people that you want to be pulling out your charts and your graphs and telling them about statistics and telling them about inflation. You know, just really stick to today. And something that I heard that I think is just really important for all of us to know is that if you're working with somebody and you're talking with them, and when they talk about their future, they're talking about this week or tomorrow or next month or within the year. I'll guarantee you, if you start talking to them about saving for retirement, there's no way, they literally will not be able to hear you. When we talk about the brain, they go into that emotional part of the brain, it slams the door to the logical part, and they literally can't even hear what you're saying. Right. So you have to talk about, how are we going to get you through this week? What can we do so that by the end of the month, you'll be able to do this?
Yep.
You know, you can start talking to them about an emergency fund, but you can't jump ahead. If someone comes in and they're saying, you know, I need to get my life in order and I want to make sure I have enough for retirement and I want to retire 10 years early, you just go right there. Find out if they're okay on a day to day, not make that assumption. But once you know they're okay, you can just jump right here and they're right where you want them to be. So
brilliant. How about security? That's our last card.
All right. So security are people who they want to make sure that they have enough to feel secure. But what does that mean? And you mentioned this with your wife, yes. Right? For some people, security means the house is paid off, their car is paid off, they have a second home someplace that's paid off, and they have $5 million in the bank, free and clear, and investments, right? For other people, security means I can pay all my bills at the end of the month.
Yes.
And that may mean just paying the minimum on my credit card.
Yep.
So unless we know what security means to people, we don't know that. But when we know that security is important to people, what we know is that they may give up things that they would enjoy. They may not be able to be generous. And one of the reasons for people who are secure, like think about Scrooge. So they're secure to the extreme. Oftentimes what I think is that inside there's a huge empty space. Mm. It's an emotional space. It's for yeah. whatever reasons they're not feeling fulfilled. And right. as a result of that, they think that money represents power and security right. and control. And in order to have that, more money to them means more power, more control. And honestly, they leave a lot of money to their heirs. So that's an upside to it.
Yeah.
You know, when things get tough, they have the money if they're willing to use it.
Right.
But oftentimes, if you're the financial person or the spouse trying to get them to lighten up, oftentimes you do need the help of somebody outside if they're willing to look at how they can get their needs met without it just being around money. So.
It's so astute to the observation you made about an emotional hole that's not filled. My wife and I were having this discussion one day and she said, "Your business just makes me feel very insecure." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, tell me more. What do you mean by that? When you say insecure, what is it?" "Well, I'm just not sure, you know, that we can count on it," essentially. And I said, "So looking back over the last 10 years, has there ever been a time, if we look at the factual information, has there ever been a time where I've made less money than the year before?" "Well, no." "Has there ever been a time in the last 10 years where our net worth has gone down?" "Well, no." And I said, "So the insecurity you're feeling has nothing to do with my business, because the business is fine. We're stable. It's growing. It's been growing for 10 years. But we need to dig into whatever that is deep down that you're feeling insecure about, because it has nothing to do with money." And mm-hmm. I maintain there's a lot of people out there that have the same thing. "Well, we need more. We need more. We need more." How much is enough?
That's the million-dollar question, is how much is enough?
Yeah. And would that number be enough? Because once you get to the $1 million, if they say that's what I need, at some level, will you feel insecure about losing it? And so, you know, one of the things around the security card that I find really interesting, Sybil, is I will often ask clients, folks that we're coaching, do you feel safe and secure in your industry, in your career? How is your ability to make money? Do you think you could go out and find another job easily? And many of them say, "Oh yeah, no problem." Then where is the security? If you lost a job and you knew you've got 2 months set aside or a HELOC to protect you on the downturn in the economy, where is the insecurity if you could easily go out and make more money? And many people don't know where to go from there. They can't really figure out I don't know what it is. I just have this nagging insecurity.
Mm-hmm. And my guess is if you worked for a corporation and you knew that every month what your paycheck would be and what your benefits are, that probably would make your wife feel more secure. But to your point, companies get bought out and they get sold, they get closed down. And when I'm coaching clients who are in that kind of situation, it comes down to more of, give me a situation when you've been resourceful. What's been a situation where you failed and how have you handled that? And frequently people are so attuned to being down on themselves and being hard on themselves.
Right.
They never stop to really look at what their personal resources are, how they think and how they approach their lives and whether or not they're resilient. And when we go there, so many people find that they've been incredibly resilient, but they were so busy just surviving that they didn't realize how resilient they were going to be or they are in the long run.
Such a great reminder. I was listening to a podcast earlier today that he basically stated the same thing in a different way. He said, we tend to think in terms of being down on ourselves, and it's an easy road to travel. You know, our neural connections, our neural pathways are wired that way, where it's like very easy just to get down on ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it requires talking to yourself about ways you've been resourceful to rewire your brain in some ways. So I love that. Love that notion. Sybil, this has been awesome. You are you are this wealth of knowledge about this topic.
Thank you.
And I know my audience is going to love this. We're going to divide this interview into two parts because there is so much to unpack on this. I would love to know, and I'm sure my tribe would, what steps should they take if they want to do money habitudes themselves? And does it work individually? Should you do it as a couple when you get a deck, or you do it online? Can you do it as a family? Tell my listeners how to access Money Habitudes.
The easy thing is just go to moneyhabitudes.com. And whether you use the cards or the online version, it really is people's preferences. The main difference is that the cards, you can flip them over and you can see all the statements. And it's really fun, particularly for couples, when they flip them over and it's like, oh my God, we're exactly alike. Or, oh my God, we have nothing in common. So a lot of people really love the cards, and then they do it with other family members. The online version comes with a pretty robust report with it. Some people love having all that information. Yes. And they love the report. Both the cards and the online version have suggestions of ways to go forward. I had one woman tell me she did the cards and she picked the suggestions from her most dominant habitude. And as a result, she went through each of those. Usually people do maybe one or two. And she said she was in a totally different place in her life. Right. So there are suggestions if you're overusing any habitude on the cards. On the online version, there's suggestions if you're overusing or underusing something, and there's no judgments. We have had many people do it with their teenage and young adult and adult children. If you are dating somebody, my two sons can tell you, pull out that deck of cards and have this conversation right off the bat.
No doubt.
Really deep information. And I've also had a number of people tell me that they have taken it to Thanksgiving family get-togethers, Christmas family get-togethers, to get different generations to talking about money, as well as the very difficult conversations of adult children with aging parents to bring the conversation in a way that's not threatening.
Yeah.
So whichever you like, the cards or the online version, I think that it'll start the conversation. It'll give you some insights and you'll enjoy it.
It will make family game night so much more interesting. I'm telling you that for sure. And I also think you're missing out on an opportunity there, Sybil. I think you ought to license the decks and the content to Tinder. Can you imagine people online dating on Tinder? They were like, oh, here are my money habitudes before we even go out on our first date. I think that would be brilliant.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah. I love the idea. I have used the deck. I use it all the time. I have it in my hand here if you're watching the video or if you're listening on audio. I've done the online version. Both are extremely streamlined. There is something about having the deck of cards in front of you that makes it very tactile and easy to have the discussion. The online version is great if you are walking someone through it online, if you want to do it on your phone. The mobile interface is amazing. And I have taken the decks to credit unions around the country and have helped use these decks as a financial coaching tool. So know that the wide range of use is limited to your own imagination, and the discussions you'll have on the back end are super valuable. Sybil, I appreciate you immensely. Thank you for being on my show.
Thank you. What a pleasure it's been to talk with you. Have a good day.
You too.